welcome to Worlds Apart. Know your market, deliver the goods, mind your looks and manners, and leave emotions at the door. Had Volodymyr Zelensky relied on those tips from the art of the deal, the now historic spat in the Oval Office may have resulted in something more amicable. But the Ukrainian president chose a different tactic, one also favored by Donald Trump. Never admitting mistakes and repeating the same thing over and over again. Where does this leave the two presidents and their respective countries? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dmitry Suslov, Deputy Director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Dmitry, it's good to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Great to see you, too.
Now, I'm sure, like most of us, you found the exchange in the Oval Office pretty jaw-dropping. What are the main takeaways for you from that spat?
Well, my main takeaway is that the Trump administration is really committed to ending the war as quickly as possible. They perceive the Ukraine war as unwinnable and as a distraction which prevents the United States from focusing on really important and strategic issues. And the second takeaway is that Trump doesn't consider Ukraine as a counterpart and as a decision maker and as an actor. Mm-hmm. Ukrainian life support depends 100% on the West. Even despite this life support, Ukraine is losing the war. This is why, according to Trump, Ukraine cannot have its own opinion. Ukraine cannot have any objections to what the United States proposes. The job of Ukraine is to gratefully accept anything which is offered by the United States, and that's it. If Ukraine rejects that offer, well, then they're doomed.
And yet we know from numerous American officials saying it publicly that the American side went out of its way to accommodate the Ukrainians. And I've heard a number of officials say that the Ukrainian side was pretty demanding in organizing this meeting. They insisted on Trump meeting Zelensky at the motorcade, on the meeting taking place in the Oval Office. And the White House obliged to all of that until it went to hellfire. What do you think the Ukrainian objective was for coming into the White House and, having the kind of meeting that they had?
Well, I think the major Ukrainian objective was to convince Donald Trump to become Joe Biden, basically to return to the policies of the previous administration, support of Ukraine, writing blank checks, and basically promote Ukrainian, not even Ukrainian, Zelensky's objective. Because, I don't think that they fully coincide, right? To convince the Trump administration to promote Zelensky's objectives, not the objectives of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they failed.
Now, Zelensky put a lot of emphasis on the quote-unquote security guarantees, and this is where Trump resisted the most. What do you think the Ukrainians were trying to get under this somewhat obscure and formal term?
Well, first, continuation of military aid without any preconditions, indefinite continuation of the military aid, ideally expansion of the military aid, a commitment of the Trump administration to write new blank checks after the Biden's budget expires. Secondly, commitment of the United States to go into war, direct war against Russia, starting Third World War. If the peace agreement somehow, is not kept by all these sides. And of course, this was completely unacceptable for the Trump White House. Mm-hmm.
Now, John Mearsheimer, one of the most prominent American policy scholars whom you know very well, suggested in one of his recent interviews that the Ukrainians were essentially trying to buy the U.S.'s military commitment and presence in Ukraine with $500 billion worth of rare earth minerals. And he said that Article 4 of that mineral deal provided for, quote, common protection of critical resources as an indirect way of tying the Americans to Ukraine. And Trump didn't want to be entangled in such a way. What's your take on it? Do you find it plausible?
Well, I think that the Trump administration made it very clear that they want money from Ukraine. They want this hypothetical $500 billion for the military aid which had been already provided, not for the future military aid, and of course not for any sorts of commitments that Ukrainians want from the United States. You know, the Trump administration wants to avoid commitments in terms of military support of Ukraine, in terms of security guarantees to the future. I think Trump is very clear that this is the job for the Europeans somehow to handle. He doesn't want to tie the United States to Ukraine in the military sense. And he doesn't want to take any obligations which would A, disrupt the peace, which Trump wants, and B, risk direct military clash between the United States and Russia, which Trump obviously wants to avoid.
Now, a popular take here in Russia is that it was a sort of neo-colonial deal designed by the Americans to extract Ukraine's mineral resources. But if Professor Mearsheimer is right, and that the Zelensky was essentially trying to coax Trump into committing to defending Ukraine, wouldn't that be pretty brazen? I mean, wouldn't that mean that Zelensky is trying to beat Trump at his own game?
Absolutely. You know, Zelensky wanted to be more Trump than Trump himself. You know, first, because actually there are strong doubts that Zelensky has those mineral resources. You know, most likely Zelensky wanted to trade air to the Trump administration, nothing in exchange for clear commitment of the United States in terms of defending Ukraine and in terms of providing indefinite military assistance. And of course, he failed in doing that, because Trump made it very clear that this money is necessary for the military aid which had been already provided by the Biden administration.
But if we take this second part of the deal, the Ukrainians trying to get the Americans in under false pretexts, I mean, I don't understand what Zelensky was counting on, because the main premise for this conflict, and Russia made it very clear, is to prevent the American presence in Ukraine. That was the reason why the Kremlin launched this operation. What do you think the calculation was, that the Kremlin would say, okay, just because it's Donald Trump, we are going to roll out the red carpet for the American troops? I mean, what was he counting on?
Well, I think Zelensky was counting on continuation of the war. You know, of course, it is absolutely clear that for Russia, any military presence, any Western military presence in Ukraine is unacceptable, be it American or European. But precisely for this reason, Zelensky wanted the commitment of American troops, and now he wants the commitment of the European troops, because Zelensky understands that his stay in power is depending on the continuation of the war. As soon as the war ends, Zelensky will be out. He wants to avoid that, despite the fact that indefinite continuation of the war inevitably results into the ultimate destruction and defeat of Ukraine. For Zelensky, in the meantime, continuation of the war is the means for his own personal, political, and physical survival, and he wants to prolong it as long as possible.
Now, much has been already said about the Ukrainian leadership's ability to assess basic reality and its own relative place in it. Do you think this very public spat in the Oval Office is likely to sober Zelensky's ambitions a bit? Or is it even possible at this point of time?
Well, it's hard to answer this question, because Zelensky is not sober, right? We all know that he is a drug user, right? And this distorts mind and psychology. However, the episode in the White House was really very striking in terms of how reality has changed, because Zelensky was used to be handled like the new Churchill, you know, like David against Goliath, right? The representative of the frontline country of the free world fighting against the global evil. And he was presented like that for 3 years by the West. And now instead he is treated like an illegitimate adventurous leader who demands something without strong cards in his hands, as Trump put it, risking the United States into the World War III, right? And so he was put into the reality. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a shocking news for Zelensky. He tried to compensate it by the Europeans, and psychologically, I think Europeans helped him a bit, but not profoundly, because Europeans cannot afford also to side fully with Zelensky against the United States. So they also convinced him, you know, to show some flexibility vis-a-vis the United States.
Now, you mentioned psychology, and I think Ukraine is a very vivid example of a nation living in a make-believe world, or to put it differently, a nation having a collective psychotic outbreak. And you can see that not only in the boorish behavior of its leadership, but also in how its intelligence services or military services are operating, in the hype that is still maintained in the media. Do you see Zelensky as the crux of the problem here, or is he just the tip of the iceberg? And if he alters his posture, or if even if he leaves office, do you think it's likely to change the way Ukraine projects itself as a nation vis-a-vis Russia or its other partners in Europe and America and around the world?
Well, you're absolutely right. Ukraine lives in a bubble. But Zelensky is a very symbolic representative of this bubble. You know, if Zelensky collapses personally, then it will be the beginning of the collapse of the bubble in general. Yes, of course, you know, he is the peak of the iceberg. And the society which lives under strong propaganda, under no freedom of speech, you know, in conditions of censorship and persecution of political rivals and so on and so forth, controllability of all the aspects of political life, no elections and so on and so forth. Of course, this is a zombie country. But the collapse of the symbol of this zombie country, namely President or, you know, Zelensky, will be the beginning of a gradual transformation, which will be shocking for the Ukrainian society. You know, as was 1945 shocking for German, for the German nation, right? They were also, I mean, they were living under similar conditions up until May 1945, believing into the ultimate victory of Führer, you know, up until the very end, but then eventually all collapsed. Mm-hmm. So, well, I think that Ukrainians, the Ukrainian society is heading towards a similar future.
But, Dmitry, this zombie country, as you put it, is right on our border, and many of us do have relatives in that country. I mean, you cannot cut the personal ties completely. And that's a pretty serious question for Russia. How it should not necessarily even build its relationship with Ukraine, but deal with Ukraine in a state that it is right now, regardless of whether there is any peace deal, you know, produced by Donald Trump or not. What's your answer to that?
Well, I think that this is precisely why Russia and the Russian government is so much talking about the rights of the Russian speaking, the rights of the Russian language, and restoration of normal conditions in Ukraine. You know, Russia is concerned not just about the military aspects of security, not just about neutral status of Ukraine, not just about demilitarization and the limits on the Ukrainian military relations with the Western countries, not just non-deployment of troops, but also certain normalization of domestic life in Ukraine, because indeed Ukrainians remain our brother country, our brother nation, with innumerable number of inter-societal links. Right? Relative links, you are absolutely right. We are not indifferent towards these people, right? And we want them to return to normalcy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Dmitry, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are you living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dmitry Suslov, Deputy Director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Dmitry, I don't know if you would agree with me, but I think one of the most refreshing and perhaps even promising changes coming out of Washington is the current leadership's approach to diplomacy. Both Secretary of State Rubio and Vice President Vance keep referencing Diplomacy 101. This is a freshman course that is taught at American universities and where students are told that in order to engage in any interstate dialogue, one needs to approach the other side with civility and respect and try to understand what the position of the other side. And I think also in his deal, in his book rather, The Art of the Deal, Donald Trump wrote extensively about investing in a relationship, in a business relationship, and also cultivating and basing your reputation on the power, on the solidity of your own word. I wonder if this change is just rhetorical, or do you think it may be for real that diplomacy once again is given, you know, the respect it deserves as a profession, as a method through which the nations communicate and engage with one another?
Well, Oksana, I think that the United States is compelled to return to diplomacy in a real sense. Diplomacy as an instrument of communication, not some kind of reward or exquisite element of relations among like-minded countries, as was the case for the previous administration. And the reason is, the reason behind that is that the United States fails. It failed to defeat Russia, to inflict strategic defeat on Russia. The United States fails in simultaneous confrontation against several great powers altogether, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, altogether. In order to get out of that situation, which the United States loses, they need to return to normal diplomacy as an instrument of communication, not just among friends and like-minded countries, but also among adversaries, among other great powers, on equal footing, of course, while recognizing the existence of the interests of the other side, right? And this is what the Trump administration is doing. But again, let me say, this is not because they sincerely wanted to do this. They are compelled to do this because of the failure, complete failure of their previous policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote recently that while this change of tone in bilateral exchanges between Moscow and Washington is welcome, it should not serve as a reason for euphoria because Russia and the United States still remain competitors. And I heard a number of your colleagues say that definitely, that's still the case. We're still competing in many areas, but we also live in a very paradoxical time when the interest, national interest of Russia and the United States happen to be aligned. They are not shared, they are not overlapping, but they just happen to be aligned. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. While remaining strategic competitors, we both benefit from resumption of cooperation, from selective cooperation, from ending the hybrid war, which existed between Russia and the United States for more than 3 years, and for ending the confrontation. Right? The United States is interested in ending confrontation with Russia because they have other priorities, because they fail to defeat Russia, and now they want to normalize relations with Russia in order to escape the war, which they cannot win, and focus their channel their priorities on more strategically important things, such as competition against China. Mm-hmm. Russia is also interested in ending the confrontation with the United States for a bulk of reasons, right? To finish Ukraine war on our terms, to establish new rules of the game in the European security, to establish limits for the geopolitical expansion of the West. To reduce sanctions, right? If we come to the question of reduction of sanctions, and there are several concrete topics in the world, be it Arctic, be it the Iranian nuclear program or strategic stability, where we both benefit from cooperation. Mm-hmm.
Now, both Putin and Trump like to put emphasis on common sense. And in neuroscience, common sense is a very interesting phenomenon. First of all, it's notably missing in people with certain schizophrenic and autistic tendencies. And also, in many ways, it's a mark of cognitive health and a balanced, embodied life. And I think we've all been missing that in international politics. I'm skeptical of even asking this question, but do you think common sense, genuine common sense, could be brought back into global affairs?
Well, I hope so. You know, the arrival of the Trump administration, which does not have ideological, very strict ideological limitations, creates preconditions for common sense. Also, common sense usually reemerges when illusions fail. Right. Again, the United States was the U.S. previous policy was based on an illusion that they can defeat Russia. Instead of maintaining normal relations with Russia. Now they are no longer having this illusion because, you know, they failed to defeat Russia militarily, they failed Russia to defeat Russia economically, they failed to isolate Russia in the world. They understand the shortages and limitations of American resources and capabilities. They understand that they need to refocus them and channel them in a more narrow sense while sacrificing something unnecessary. So this really creates preconditions for the revival of common sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, while the Americans have seemed to come to terms with their limitations, the European partners seem to be holding a competition for the most belligerent or nastiest tweet either about Vladimir Putin and Russia or about Donald Trump and the United States. Where do you think all of this leaves our European neighbors?
Well, unfortunately, you know, Europe is in a very difficult situation, and we are doomed for continuation of confrontation with European Union and collective Europe, I would say, at large, for two reasons. First, Russophobia and confrontation against Russia has really become a pillar of European integration. This is something that brings them together. This is, they need confrontation in order to keep the European Union together, to strengthen integration, to deepen even integration in order to confront Russia. You know, they use this confrontation with Russia as a justification for, you know, increase of defense spending, deepening the security integration, defense integration, and so on and so forth. Second reason. You know, in the United States, the administration changed. And Donald Trump explicitly claims that the policies of the Biden administration were mistaken. He claims that the beginning of Ukraine war is Biden's fault and Zelensky's fault, but mainly Biden's fault. So the change of the administration created opportunity for the United States to start a different policy. In Europe, nothing changed. You know, we see the same people, we see the same elites. And of course, they cannot afford to recognize the bankruptcy of their previous policy because they would be, you know, you know, they would disappear. They would be washed away. So they are they are compelled to continue the same policy, even although it is doomed for to fail.
But Dmitry, it's one thing to call Vladimir Putin all the negative name in the book, but it's another thing to do the same thing to Donald Trump. And we see from Trump's reaction to Zelensky's posture that he didn't wait long to pull the carpet of military support from under the Ukrainians. Do you think he may do something of the kind to the Europeans? Is there actually a cost to all this European grandstanding, a possible cost?
This is precisely why I said that Europe is in a very difficult situation, because on the one hand, of course, they try to consolidate against Donald Trump. Right. Many of them explicitly describe Donald Trump as their adversary. But on the other hand, they cannot afford a split against the United States, because despite all the rhetoric, Europe is not an independent geopolitical player. Europe is not a significant military player. Europe is dependent on the United States militarily, politically, and economically. Europe does not want to accelerate a trade war against the United States. Europe is extremely afraid of the U.S. pullout from Europe and undermining the NATO Article 5 commitment. So they are dependent on the United States, and they want, of course, some reconciliation with the Trump administration, and look at the Macron's and Starmer's visits to Washington. But at the same time, of course, they try to use Donald Trump also as the significant other, you know, together with Russia, which consolidates the European Union. Mm-hmm.
Dmitry, you mentioned that Europeans are not independent players. And to illustrate that point, I want to bring up some of the data on the structure of the transatlantic relationship. At this point of time, the United States provides roughly 70% of NATO's financial budgeting, around 80% of its weaponry, more than 80% of its intelligence and reconnaissance capacity, about 70% of its air and ABM defenses, and the list goes on. I mean, this is a highly skewed and very dependent relationship for the Europeans. What I don't understand is why they think it's a good idea to try to salvage it by writing dismissive posts about Donald Trump.
They are absolutely dependent on the United States. And of course, the turn of the United States towards the Pacific, you know, decoupling, the security decoupling, ideological decoupling between the United States and Europe, and undermining of the Atlantic community is existential threat to the current European elites. So this is why they try to somehow remedy this situation by simultaneously anti-Trump rhetoric, increase of the defense spending and integration of the European Union, but at the same time combining it with, you know, maintaining of cooperation with the United States in a cooperative way, through visits, through trying to, you know, engage Trump, disrupt the U.S.-Russian negotiations by bringing some European ideas and initiatives really aimed at disruption, not peace, but disruption and continuation of the war, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, the Europeans would want to outlive Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, they understand that this is the last presidential term of the Trump administration. They understand that next year there will be midterm elections in the U.S. Congress, and quite likely Trump will become more restrained in his behavior if Democrats establish control over one of the chambers of the Congress. So they want to wait for kind of this for this situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, not sure that is a successful strategy, but I guess we will see in the next couple of months. Mitch, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, my pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.